We'll be turning to the book of Ruth, please. The book of Ruth. We'll be looking at that book this evening. As I stated on Sunday, I'm grateful for BJ taking my place on Sunday morning preaching, and then James, both Sunday and Wednesday, teaching my class. And last week, he covered the book of Job. We're trying to do this in chronological order of the books written, in the order in which they were written. Not the order of the events, but the order in which they were written. There's been a couple of exceptions, and one of these was with the book of Chronicles. You remember I included that immediately after Kings, even though it was written much later than that, because I wanted y'all to see the differences between Chronicles and Kings, or Kings and Chronicles, rather. And then last week was kind of an exception with Job, because we aren't exactly sure when it was written. And so exactly where to place it is a matter of debate. I tend to think personally that it was probably written during the time of David or Solomon, when the wisdom literature really became very popular, although that's not for sure. And so I wanted to go ahead and get Job out of the way, and now we're going back into more chronological order, and we'll go on from there. When does the events of Ruth take place, however? Not when it was written, but when do the events of Ruth take place? Yeah, look at Ruth 1, verse 1. It tells us exactly when it takes place, at least the time frame, the period. It says, now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled. Now, granted, the days that the judges ruled was a period of, depending upon who you talk to, about 300 years or so. Can we narrow it down any more than that? Okay, Lisa's saying, well, there's a marker there, a clue about a famine, but you'd have to have some kind of other reference as to what famine that would be speaking about and when that would be, which we don't. Okay, if you look at the genealogy at the end of the book, then you can kind of backdate it from there, because who is Ruth's famous descendant that is mentioned in that genealogy? David. Yeah, Ruth is David's great-grandmother. And we know when David reigned, and so you can work your way back in time from there and get a rough estimate as to when this would have taken place. So the date of the events would have been somewhere around 1100 B.C., because we know David's reign started in 1041 B.C., and so you can go back, you know, you can estimate from there. But somewhere around 1100 B.C. And what are the locations? There are two primary locations that these events take place in the book of Ruth. Okay, Moab is one, and what's the other? Not Jerusalem. Bethlehem. Okay, so you have Moab and Bethlehem being the places mentioned here as the primary locations. And actually, Moab is just the first chapter after that. As everything takes place in Bethlehem. So, let's talk about the author. As with many of the Old Testament books that we've seen, the author is not stated, and so we don't really know who it was, but any educated guesses out there as to whom it might be? I heard, say it? Okay, Solomon is a good guess. Anybody else? Samuel is probably the most popular choice as to whom wrote the book. So it could have been him. Now, remember, Samuel was a prophet, and as well as of his other duties as a judge and so forth, and a priest. And prophets were heavily involved in writing of the Old Testament. Who was another prophet that was contemporary with David that may be a good choice? Nathan. Yeah, Nathan the prophet. Those are two of the most popular choices that are put out there by scholars. as to being the likely candidates for writing it. Now, the date of events within the book, we know obviously take place before David, because it's talking about Ruth, his great-grandmother. But when it was written, might have been somewhere in Samuel's or Nathan's lifetime, even if they were not the ones writing it. And the reason why we can narrow it down as to when it would have been written is because obviously David is mentioned in the genealogy, so David had to have been alive when the book of Ruth was written. But what descendant is not named? David's son, Solomon. So there's a possibility that it was written before Solomon was born, and Samuel would still fit the bill for that. So don't really know for sure, but probably written, and this goes to that, late during Saul's reign or early in David's reign is the likely time frame in which the book of Ruth would have been written. So this places it within the same time frame as the book of Samuel. Okay? Now we had to get through Samuel and Kings, and now we're kind of going back and we're going to be filling in the gaps now with books like Ruth and other prophets, major prophets and minor prophets, as we go through this Old Testament overview. Let's take a look at a very simple outline next. In chapter 1, you have Naomi and Moab, and then her return to Bethlehem. In chapter 2, Ruth meets Boaz during the harvest. In chapter 3, you have Naomi's plan for Ruth's security. And then in chapter 4, Boaz redeems Naomi and Ruth. And we will talk about, obviously, the story and the details of this a little bit more in detail. But before we, well, you know what, let's go ahead and talk about some of that now. Ruth is probably a story that most of us are very familiar with, or at least somewhat familiar with. Now, we said that part of the story takes place in Moab. Let's make sure we understand the context and the background of Moab. Who was Moab in relation to Israel? And I'm talking about the country, not individuals. Where do they come into the picture? Are they related, or are they just complete foreigners? Okay, descendants of Lot. You recall that rated R section of the scriptures where God goes sends the angels to Sodom and Gomorrah, and the angels are finally able to convince Lot and whom else to leave Sodom and Gomorrah before they destroy it. Who came out of Sodom? Okay, Lot, his wife, and their two daughters, not even their sons-in-laws. And, well, of course, Lot's wife looked back, turned to a pillar of salt, so that left just Lot and his two daughters. And what were the two daughters' thought process when they saw all the destruction of the cities of the plain, Sodom and Gomorrah, and I think the implication is there were probably other cities involved in that destruction process, but what did they say to themselves? Okay, they wanted to provide descendants to their dad, but before they got to that point, they were saying, there's no other man alive to provide us with children. And so they devised this absolutely horrible, wicked plan to get their father drunk. They took turns getting him drunk and then having sexual relations with their dad. And each one of them bore a child. Who were the two children? Moab and Ammon. Okay, so you have the Moabites and the Ammonites that come. So that's the relationship between Moab and Israel. And so they are distantly related, just like the Edomites were. Okay. So you have a famine in the land, and that forces Elimelech, which is Naomi's husband, and then Naomi and their two sons to go to Moab because there apparently is food in Moab. Anybody recall how long they stay there? If you skim through chapter 1, you can find it. But I'm hearing it from somebody. About 10 years while they stay there. What happens to Naomi's sons while they're there and her husband? Okay, all three of them died in Moab. And now the two sons had already married, and so she's Naomi is left with her two daughters-in-law. And finally, she decides she's going to go back home because she learned somehow or another, in verse 6, in fact, it says, then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. So through the grapevine, she finds out that Bethlehem area has food again, has bread again. The famine is no more. And so she goes back. Verse 8, she encourages Naomi and the other daughter-in-law to, excuse me, she encourages Ruth and the other daughter-in-law to return home. In verse 8, Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, go return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband. And so the other daughter-in-law does go back home, but Naomi, of course, famously in verse 14 and 15, or 15 rather, 15 and 16, makes this statement. Orpha goes home. Verse 15, Naomi says to Ruth, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. Basically, what is Ruth willing to do? There's one word that describes this process. It's a technical religious word when it comes to the Jews. And, yeah, she's becoming a proselyte, is she not? She's proselytizing to Judaism and is willing to give up her homeland, her country, her gods to now follow Yahweh and be a part of the Jewish nation. Do you realize the application here and the great things that says about Naomi? I mean, if she did not have this trust in Naomi, if she didn't have this relationship with Naomi, and Naomi speaking apparently about Yahweh to her during those years, she would have had no desire to go there, but they built this relationship. And let me just make this quick application, folks, that relationships are absolutely critical when it comes to speaking to others about the gospel. Can you be successful in getting somebody interested in the gospel of Jesus Christ without you having a family and a relationship or a very close bond with them? Yes, you can. But when you have that connection, it makes a big difference. It's kind of hard to tell your close friend no on something that they're asking you to do, even when you don't want to do it, isn't it? Have you ever done that before? Have you ever said yes to somebody, to a request, even when you didn't want to, because they're a family member or because they're a very close friend of yours? Okay. Well, let's not be hesitant about sharing our faith with our family members or our close friends. Chances are they will say yes to a Bible study. Chances are they will say yes to an invitation of some kind to study the Bible or read the Bible together. Naomi had that connection with her, and Ruth said, you know what? I'm going to be a Jew now. Giving up worshiping Chemosh, worshiping the other gods of the Moabites, and came to Bethlehem with her. Okay, somebody tell me about what the socioeconomic situation would be for Naomi and Ruth, both widows. Say again? Poorest of the poor. Did they have Social Security to fall back on? Did they have Medicare to fall back on? Or Medicaid? Of course. Did they have any kind of social welfare program to fall back on, to where the government was going to take care of them? What were they completely dependent upon? Okay, relatives would be one, yes. Okay. And that's the example that we see in this story, is that when the harvest came, the poor, as mandated in the old law by God, for the benefit of the poor was they were allowed to glean in other people's fields. Now, what specifically, what area were they allowed to glean? Okay, the edges, the corners, and they could go along behind the reapers, the harvesters, and get what had been, get what fell to the ground. Okay, so the poor could go along and do that. Yes, that was kind of a trick question I was asking about there. In this theocracy that you have there with the Jewish nation, that was how God took care of the poor and how he wanted the people to take care of the poor. It wasn't some government program necessarily, like what we have where you have a distribution of funds, but that was the way it was supposed to be, that people could go through, the poor people could go through other people's fields and glean whatever was left over. And that's what we have Ruth doing in chapter 2, where she goes to the field of Boaz, and Boaz, of course, is a relative of Ruth, excuse me, of Naomi, rather, and she goes and gleans the heads of grain after him. Take a look at what Boaz says to her, if you will, please, in verse 11. This is after Boaz has been told who that woman is in the field. And Boaz tells Ruth, actually, if you back up to verse 8, don't go anywhere else. Don't go to any other fields. You stay right here with my reapers, and we'll make sure that you get what you need. And so her response in verse 10 is, why have I found favor in your eyes? I'm a foreigner of all people. You shouldn't be worrying about me or taking care of me. And look at what he says in verse 11. It has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you have left your father and your mother and the land of your birth and have come to a people whom you did not know before. May the Lord repay your work and a full reward be given you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. So not only was Naomi apparently a good enough woman to be trusted by Ruth and for Ruth to leave her home and follow Naomi, but then Ruth's reputation started to go out amongst the people there in Bethlehem, to where Boaz had already heard about her and everything she had been doing. It speaks a lot about Ruth and her character. So she continues to glean there. He goes out of her way to provide for her. And what is Naomi's then suggestion or prodding to Ruth? What does she tell Ruth that you need to do once she hears about all that Boaz is doing? Okay, come and eat with them. What does she want for Ruth to do with Boaz? Okay, wants her to go to him where he's sleeping at night at the threshing floor. The threshing season is still going on, the harvest season. And what basically takes place in chapter 3? What is Ruth doing? When she goes and lays down, obviously an ancient custom to lay down at the feet of him in bed, and something about covering up his feet or uncovering his feet. I mean, really strange. I think if I woke up, if I was single and I woke up and there's some woman laying at the foot of my bed, I would freak out just a little bit. And he is startled when he wakes up and realizes that someone is there. And this is kind of a weird way to do it, but what is she in effect asking him and doing with him? Yeah, she's proposing, isn't she? She's the one doing the proposing. And instead of getting down on one knee and popping out a ring, she lays down at the foot of his bed and uncovers his feet. Okay. Now, ladies, Tana, don't go proposing to any guys. That's not the way we do it here, okay? And certainly don't allow her to go to some boy's bed and lay down in the bed. Yeah. No sexual overtones here, guys. No sexual overtones at all. Just because he was asleep there in the threshing floor and her laying at the feet, nothing to do with sexual immorality at all. So she comes and she proposes that Boaz takes her as a wife. why did Naomi tell Ruth that this is the man in particular you need to do that with? What's special about Boaz? Okay, he was rich for one. He could certainly provide for them. What else? He was a relative, and specifically a very close relative. And what is brought up here in chapter 3 and 4 is this idea of redemption. And by the way, let me point out one other verse before I go into that. Take a look at chapter 3, verse 11. When she proposes in verse 9, she says, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative." Notice what he says about her character again in verse 11. "And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman." So now it's not just him that has heard about it through others, but he says, all the people of Bethlehem know that you are a virtuous woman. Ruth is the epitome in this book of the Proverbs 31 woman. A worthy woman, a virtuous woman. A woman of excellence, your version may say. And so he mentions being a close relative. She mentions being a close relative. He indeed says that he is a close relative. Verse 12, however, there was somebody closer than him. And they go through this process in chapter 4 of deciding which relative is going to redeem her. Now, this may be strange language to our 21st century ears when it comes to marriage and a widow. We don't talk about redeeming somebody today when we talk about marrying somebody. What is the concept behind this redemption that is mentioned here in the book of Ruth? Okay, it was a duty to take care of them. That's one aspect of it. What's the other aspect of it, of that duty? To continue the family line. And remember, Ruth's husband died before they had children. And so if Ruth doesn't have children, then that particular line dies out. Now, this particular law or custom was called a levirate marriage. Let me spell that for you. It's L-E-V-I-R-A-T-E, levirate marriage. Now, when you hear L-E-V-I, you may immediately think, oh, that has something to do with Levi. Nope, it has nothing to do with Levi. It comes from the Latin word lever, L-E-V-I-R, which means husband's brother. So it was the responsibility of the closest relative, maybe starting with the husband's brother, to take up the widow and bear children for that widow. There's a story in the Old Testament besides Ruth that talks about this. Do y'all remember who that was? That he was supposed to take up his brother's wife and produce children and refused? Okay, yeah, Judah's son. You have two of his sons, actually, that were supposed to take up their brother's widow who had not had children and produce children for her. Those children would not be, at least the first child, would not be the descendant of the relative that then redeemed her. It belonged to the dead husband. And those children of Judah, the first one refused, and what happened? God killed him. The second one did go in to her, but then did not continue the process, I'll put it that way, and God killed him as well. Okay, so that's the concept behind this, is that to help take care of the individual, provide for them, and then ultimately to produce children for that widow that would then go through the dead husband's line. So that's what the basis of what's going on here in this levirate marriage and being redeemed that we have in chapter 3 and 4. And Boaz eventually is the one that redeems, actually, both Naomi and Ruth in this instance, marries Ruth, but of course is taking care of Naomi in the process. And it closes with the genealogy in verse 18, going back, starting with Perez, and going all the way to David, four generations in the future from Ruth. Okay, so that's the story behind all this, but let me ask this question. What's the point of Ruth being in the canon of Scripture? Why do we have Ruth? Why is it necessary that Ruth's story have been written down in the first place, and then secondly, not just written down, but included as Scripture, as part of the canon of Scripture, even when other writings were not included? What's so special about Ruth? I think that's certainly one of the implications that we can get from the story of Ruth, where you have a foreigner who is now included as part of God's people. Now, granted, she proselytized, which means she became Jewish, even though she, you know, ethnically wasn't 100% Jew. I mean, she had the same ancestor, of course, but that's certainly one implication of this is the broader reach of who is God's people. Did you have your hand up? Okay. Lisa mentions in the genealogies of Jesus, both in Matthew and Luke, you have mentioned actually four different women, if I remember the number correctly. Ruth is one of them. Who are the other four women? Or the other three women, I should say? Do y'all remember who else is in the... Somebody else? Rahab. There you go. That's what happens when you get old, Terrell. And so Rahab was also a foreigner. She was a Canaanite, but she became a Jew. She proselytized to Judaism as well. All right, who else? Who was David's wife? I think I heard it. Bathsheba. Okay. Bathsheba may have been, this is a matter of debate, may have been a Hittite just like her husband. We don't know for sure, but and then there's one other thing, and I'm forgetting now who it was. But Lisa's point is that what you were saying, Gail, is even brought out in the genealogy of Jesus. That not every ancestor of Jesus was Jewish by birth, but rather became one of God's people. Okay? What else? Why else would Ruth be in the Bible? I mean, while I agree with everything that you and Lisa were saying, couldn't that have just been stated in a couple of verses? Why a whole story on it? Why a whole story on this particular woman and this particular story, and you don't have everybody's story told? Okay, I think the providence of God is all through this, with some deeper implications that I want to look at regarding that, but it shows God kind of being the arranger of this, and let's talk about that further, but after Jimmy's comment. Okay, Jimmy, she stole your thunder. Okay, think about when this was written. Say that again. There you go. Yeah. Whether or not David had ascended to the throne when this was written, we don't know. But think to the normal process of things in kingdoms of the ancient Near East. Who should have been on the throne after Saul? Jonathan. Or at least somebody of his descendants. One of his descendants, right? So, why is David on the throne? Well, because we know in Samuel, in 1 Samuel 16, that God sent Samuel to the house of Jesse to anoint David. And of course, we know the story of the sins of Saul and how God rejected him and so forth. But this needed to be shown to everybody that God chose David, and this was, like you said, setting up David. The legitimacy of David's kingship would be part of this. And let me just go ahead and set that up for you. God's providence in providing a ruler is one of the major theological purposes of this. And if you go back to the original promise to Abraham, and that starts in Genesis 12, but in Genesis 17, one of the comments that is made to both Abraham and Sarah is that kings will come from you. That exact promise is then reiterated to Jacob in Genesis 35 and verse 11. And then again in Genesis 49 and in verse 10, you have Jacob blessing, known as Israel this time, blessing each of his sons. And remember, Genesis 49 and verse 10, one of the messianic prophecies is talking about Judah, the scepter will not depart from his feet until Shiloh comes. Okay, and Shiloh being a reference to the Messiah. And so you have these prophecies about kings coming through this line, and then in Genesis 49 it specifically mentions that's going to come through Judah. What tribe was Saul from? From Benjamin, not Judah. So there's another aspect of the legitimacy of David ruling versus Saul and his descendants ruling. Okay. No prophecy about Benjamin being the ruling lineage, the ruling tribe. Judah was. And then, of course, ultimately, what we know through the New Testament is who is the ultimate king that came through the line of David, and ultimately through Ruth, Jesus. Okay. So God prophesied about rulers coming, and not just physical ruler. He ultimately had in mind Jesus, and we have that Davidic covenant that we looked at when we were going through Samuel, where he prophesied, where God foretold about David's son and how God will build him a house and so forth. So God's providence in providing a ruler is one of the major theological purposes of the book of Ruth. As I said with Kings and Samuel, even going back to the other historical books, it's not just history. We need to remember that as we go through these books of the Old Testament, these what we typically call historical books, it's not there just for us to learn dates and learn facts of history. They're written for theological reasons, not for historical reasons. God's faithfulness in providing rest. Okay, now you may scratch your head to begin with and say, what on earth does Ruth have to do with God providing rest? So, let me ask you, what do you see in the story of Ruth that has to do with God providing rest? Think first about the immediate characters in the story. You have Ruth and Naomi, widows, completely dependent upon the generosity of others, and God provides security for them, does he not? Through Boaz. Then you have Ruth's descendant David, and what is he very, very well known for during his reign? He was a man of war. Why did he need to be a man of war? Because of all the nations around that had not been conquered, that they were supposed to have conquered hundreds of years prior, right? Had the Israelites truly had rest from their enemies up until the time of David? Everybody shake your head no. They had not. Now, God had promised them rest. God had promised that everybody would be taken care of, their enemies would be taken care of, but they failed on their part to do what was necessary. And it wasn't until David, who was the most of the conquering kings there, to drive out everybody so that when Solomon took the throne, you had a time of peace that they had not had in their entire history. David was responsible for that. So you have providing rest to Naomi and to Ruth. Ultimately, through their descendants, you have the nation being provided rest. And then we definitely need to look at the book of Ruth with a messianic tone as well. Who else provides rest, ultimately, spiritually? The descendant of David, descendant of Ruth, Jesus provides rest. Okay, so that now, obviously, when this was written, that last point would not have been obvious to everybody. They wouldn't have gotten that yet. But that's something that would have come out once the New Testament came about. And God's grace in providing redemption. The word redeem, redeemer, redemption, and kinsman redeemer. Those words are used 20 times in the book of Ruth, short book. And that word, or that idea of redemption, is all through the book. Think messianic. And who would Boaz represent? Boaz is a type of Christ. And going back to what Gail said earlier, you have a foreigner, not just a Jew, but a foreigner who is redeemed by a man that is a Jew, that provides that rest, that provides that redemption, that provides that security, that takes care of not only Naomi, but Ruth. Okay, so Boaz becomes a type of Christ and is a foreshadowing of Christ in this way. And, of course, redemption, the concept of redemption in the New Testament with Christ and his work is synonymous. So we have that represented here in a physical sense, but it is a foreshadowing of what was to come through the line of Ruth, through the line of David, with the Messiah. Does everybody see that? Questions, comments about the reason why Ruth would be written, or those purposes, or any other concepts or themes that you find in the book of Ruth? Okay. All right, so I want to end on a controversial note, on a question that has been debated ad nauseum and that people are not exactly sure the answer to, but you need to be aware of it, okay? Everybody go to Deuteronomy 23, please. And in the last 6 or 7 minutes, we'll talk about this particular issue. Deuteronomy 23. Beginning in verse 1, you have some prohibitions of those who were excluded from the assembly of the Lord, is the way the New King James translates it. I believe most translations have it that way, the assembly of the Lord. Looking at verse 1, he who is emasculated by crushing or mutilation shall not enter the assembly of the Lord. One of illegitimate birth shall not enter the assembly of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord. An Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter the assembly of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of his descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord forever, because they did not meet you with bread and water on the road when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. It goes on in verse 7, you shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. You shall not abhor an Egyptian, because you were an alien in his land. The children of the third generation born to them may enter the assembly of the Lord. So you have eunuchs, those who are emasculated, those who are damaged in some way, some, you know, men who have had issues with their sexual organs. They are not allowed to enter into the assembly of the Lord. Illegitimate children are not allowed to enter. And Ammonites and Moabites, not allowed to enter. but Egyptians and Edomites can. What's the potential problem with this verse? Ruth is a Moabite. Who's Ruth's famous descendant we've been talking about? David. What was David's role? He was king. He wasn't just anybody in the Jewish nation. He was the king. Now, here's the issues with this verse. Some things that we have to consider. Number one, we got to define what it means to be part of the assembly of the Lord. Let me ask this question because I believe this one is pretty obvious answer. But does being a part of the assembly of the Lord mean just being part of the congregation of Israel, of the Israelite nation? Does it mean that somebody who is a eunuch or somebody that's been emasculated or crushed or mutilated in some way, that they are not allowed to be associated in any way with the Israelite nation? Can they have no, are they being barred from being a Jew? Okay. No, I don't think that we need to go that far. Illegitimate children, are they being barred from being a part of the nation of Israel? Is that what it means by being excluded from the assembly of the Lord? I don't think that that would be the case. In fact, going back to the example of a eunuch, who do we know in the New Testament, while the old law was still in effect, that was most likely a Jewish proselyte? Acts chapter 8, the Ethiopian eunuch. Okay, so he was not excluded from being a Jew. So I don't think the assembly of the Lord means just being a part of the nation. And then, of course, Ammonite and Moabite, whatever assembly of the Lord means would apply to them as well. And so what does assembly of the Lord mean? Here's an option. One of the options is not allowed to be a part of the public worship of the congregation of Israel. You could be on the outskirts, but you couldn't take part in the actual worship feasts and festivals and so forth. And so then, if that's the case, then you've got to say that the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8, that while he went to Jerusalem for the feast, he was just there milling around with the millions of other people, but wasn't allowed to participate in all the festivities. May have been the case. But if it means not allowed to participate in the festivals and the feast and the worship and sacrifices, obviously when Deuteronomy is written at the tabernacle and then later on at the temple, then what about David? We know he worshipped. We know that he was part of that process. So, what do we do? Well, we've been talking about proselytes. When a Jew becomes a proselyte, excuse me, that doesn't make any sense, does it? When a foreigner becomes a proselyte to Judaism, whether it be an Ammonite, a Moabite, an Egyptian, whatever, are they any longer legally, or even just, are they viewed this way by the Jews? Are they viewed as a Moabite or an Ammonite or an Egyptian or wherever they're from? They are no longer viewed as a foreigner. They are viewed as a Jew. And so that is one possible explanation of this verse, is that this is not talking about proselytes. This is talking about pagans not being allowed to be a part of the assemblies and of the rituals and so forth. Don't know for sure. There are a couple of other verses that I'll throw out to you at the beginning of class next time. We're out of time now, that might want to be taken into consideration. I don't view this as that big of a deal, but it is something you need to be aware of. There are skeptics who will bring this up. And so we'll take a look at closing that out next time, and then move on to the next book from there. Thank you, guys.